This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 11th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 35th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we've put all our idea tiles into a bag and shaken them up, allowing them to form an entirely random story list. What luck for you, dear listener, that they're all crackers. First of all, we went to see what was cooking at Pinta, the largest South American art fair outside of, you guessed it, South America. The Latin market's going gangbusters.
So there is a very dynamic sort of demand and market in London for art, and also possibly for Latin American art.
And then what do you think we did in Las Vegas? Nope, not that. Not that either. In fact, we went to the Neon Museum to put the spiritual home of flashing tubes in an artistic context, kind of.
People latch on to the neon sign all over the world because it is spectacular.
And we'll hear from Amani Olu about his new curatorial spectacular in New York, which brings together the creative minds of 12 up-and-coming curators.
I want to work with curators who are producing exhibitions that don't really work inside a normal gallery program. This is a space to experiment. This is a space to fail, to triumph.
Plus, what 60 years of journalism have taught Spanish reporter Pura Ramos, and we'll head to New York to speak to photographer Harry Benson. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But before all that, from my album of the week, new from Saint Xavier, from the album called Union, this is Tightrope.
I walked a tightrope without a care. The crowd took pictures. I walked the morning air. When I was falling.
And that was Saint Xavier singing Tightrope. And that's from her new record, or her debut album, which is out on June the 25th. It's amazing, beautiful, brilliant, and haunting. You'll be able to hear more from that later on in this very show. The Latin American contemporary art market is well and truly booming, with sales up year on year and big international collectors paying increasing attention and hefty price tags for new Latin American art, as well as modern classics from the last half century. Now in its fifth year, and 3 years after moving to London, the Pinta Art Fair is the place to see the very best of artists from Brazil to Ecuador. 2012 also sees the introduction of Spanish and Portuguese artists to the mix. Monocle's David Pleasant went to London's Earls Court Exhibition Centre to meet some of the artists, galleries and collectors that flocked to Pinta's opening night.
I am Mauro Herlitzka, Institutional Director of Pinta. Pinta, it's the third edition here in London. We had already five in New York, and we're very happy to have presenting the Latin American art for the Londonian audience. I think so for Europe is the main market, and also we are introducing new ways of art and new artists, as people from Salart, Sprovieri, Enrique Faria Gallery, that they are introducing not only just very contemporary art, but a lot of artists that were working here in the 60s and 70s in London that came from Latin America. And then we can show new cross-cultural currents. You see here many masters of abstraction, and also they came from Spain, from Portugal, even the very contemporary artists. Then you have a map, and you can read Latin American art within Latin American international scenarios.
Would you say that there's a moment for Latin American art at the moment?
There's a very increasing Latin American art knowledge in Europe and in the United States. Already in Latin America, the market is strong, the structure of museum, cultural institutions, university is very big. But now that those interactions with institutions, galleries, artists, the magazines, everything, that's another point of view and another understanding, a new reading on Latin American art.
Why London? Why is it that that Pinta is held here?
Well, London is the big cultural capital in the world, I think, so a lot of things merge here, and there's very interesting Latin American things, as for example, Essex University is the only university who has a PhD on Latin America art history in Europe, and the Tate Modern has the larger Latin American art group supporter in the world outside Latin America.
My name is Mateus Rocha Pitam.
And we're standing in your own cubicle here at Pinta. Maybe you could describe a little bit about the works that you've chosen.
Recently, we have made works around consumption. The first one, the main pieces, are these sculptures and photographs of a man carrying, one is carrying like Sainsbury's bags. It's a very, you know, very common action you do in your life, carrying bags from the supermarket to home. And you see this common image in the photograph, and then the body of the photograph person is exchange positions with the commodities themselves. So the body for my model is inside a big, huge Sainsbury bag.
Is there a connection to your home country here with these pieces?
If there is something Brazilian here, maybe it's playfulness. Mm-hmm. It's been serious, but very playful.
Obviously, Pinta seems to be growing from strength to strength. What are your feelings on it?
Although, like, I don't like very much the tag of like Latin American art. Mm-hmm. I think it might be very reducing sometimes, but at the same time, it's good to have this small-scale art fair, which I think it's the scale of it is really nice. Mm-hmm. It's not as big as the other ones.
Yeah. Could I ask you a few questions for Monocle Radio Station?
From Monaco?
Monocle Radio.
Oh, I love it. Go on. What do you want to know? I'm single. I'm 30. I've been coming here for the last 3 years, so I guess I like it.
And I mean, it's big. It's spacious. The materials are nice. And you can always see something, I suppose, that might attract your eye. Not that I'm going to buy it, but it's good. Probably, if it's going to be big, it'll be here.
Yes. Yeah.
Catherine Petigas, I'm a collector of Latin American art, and I'm part of the Pinta Committee, and also I've been a member of the Latin American Acquisitions Committee at the Tate for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it happens to be in London? Why is it that this is the point where the only Latin American art fair is held internationally? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any particular reason you think that might be happening?
I think probably in the first place, the idea that there is a very dynamic sort of demand and market, I hate the word, but certainly a market in London for art, and also possibly for Latin American art. I think the fact that the Tate has launched this acquisition effort over the past 10 years has also been quite instrumental in the founder's decision to base the fair in London.
Yeah.
And there is a big community of Latin American artists, actually. We probably don't take advantage of this enough, but they are really
You're tapping
quality.
That resource.
Yes, yeah. They are high-quality artists from Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Chile, who live here. So yes, there is a big community of Latin American artists. Also.
And I mean, what are your impressions on the show this year? It's early on in the evening, but
yes.
I imagine you know a lot about who's exhibiting.
Yes, I've seen about half of the show so far, and I think I've been caught mostly in the historical section, which is also a great passion of mine, so the modernism of Latin America. Mm-hmm. I've seen some really very high-quality pieces. I think that what I love about Pinta here in London, compared to Pinta in New York, where the fair started,
yes.
is that in New York it's much bigger and it's less selective. I think here there are fewer galleries, I think about 55, 60 this year, and there is a presentation that is very focused on modernism, conceptual art, constructivism, and I think there is a very coherent display. And as a result, I think, you know, even people who don't know about Latin American art find this fair interesting.
Yeah. So there's plenty for everyone, not just the grand collectors like yourself.
Yes. I think you see the audience is quite diverse, and I think people just want to learn a bit more.
That was Catherine Pettigrass speaking to David Pleasant at the Pinta Art Fair in London. Now, Las Vegas has the image of a gaudy city bereft of culture, but it is in fact a mecca for a largely unrecognised form of visual art, the neon sign. The city even has a neon museum, which is currently off the tourist track, but set for a big revamp. Monocle's Alistair G reports on how the museum is primed to become a cultural landmark and an anchor for Vegas' revitalised downtown.
What you are looking at is what I consider the true treasures of Las Vegas. You know, where our skyline is a nighttime skyline, and so, you know, when you think of the great cities of the world, you think of their architectural icons, you think of Big Ben, you think of the Empire State Building, and when you think of Las Vegas, you think of a nighttime skyline that is populated not by architecture but by signage, and it illuminates the desert sky, and these are those relics. I'm Danielle Kelly, I'm the Executive Director of the Neon Museum.
Tell me about the new visitor center that you have planned.
There's a building called the La Concha Motel Lobby, and that building was built in 1961. It originally sat on Las Vegas Boulevard on the Strip proper, what everyone knows as the Strip, and it sat next to the Riviera. And we saved that building from demolition in 2006, and we brought it to the site of our boneyard, and it was designed by Paul Revere Williams, who was the first black architect admitted into the American Institute of Architects. And it's also one of the few remaining mid-century modern and or Googie design buildings in Las Vegas. It has these sweeping, beautiful parabolas, as the name might imply, La Concha. It's the shape of a seashell, essentially, was the inspiration.
So tell me about some of your favorite signs.
Well, right now, we're standing next to the City Center Motel sign. And something I love about the City Center Motel sign is that there's a mixture of different kinds of topographies in it, something that I really love. It makes things so, you know, sort of visually, it's animated, it's fun to look at. And then across the top is a profile of an urban skyline that looks nothing like Las Vegas. It's got all these tall buildings, and our buildings are, you know, well, now they're more tall buildings, but really our architecture was always low to the ground, a couple stories maximum. But this, I love that it evokes this idea of a city center with tall buildings that really looks nothing like Las Vegas. This is one of my favorite signs. And then coming up here, we're looking at pieces of the Yucca Motel sign. And if you look right here, it says Sleaze and it says 83. Now, what this means, or what this is pointing to, is that in 1983, a sign tech named Sleaze repainted this sign.
Ah.
So, you know, when a sign is up, no matter its age, it has to be maintained all the time. So the neon gets maintained, but not just that, the paint has to be maintained. The look of it has to be, you know, kept relatively, you know, in good shape. So there's constant repainting that happens of the signage, and the sign techs, who are true heroes as far as I'm concerned, they often would sneak their autograph on signs that they would repaint. We're the proud owners of 3 Sleazes here at the Neon Museum, so big fan.
It's like the neon version of graffiti tagging.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sleaze is one of the artists whose hands have touched this sign.
Right now, the boneyard is just that. It's just a boneyard. What significance will this new visitor center have for the museum?
As any organization will tell you, once you have bricks and mortar, that's a real game changer. To have a building to say that is your, you know, your home, it really psychologically is significant, not only for you as an organization and how you feel about what you're doing, but also how you're perceived. It shows that people's donation dollars are going somewhere significant and real physically. What it also means is that we can provide more tours, which is really what we're super, super excited about, because as it stands, we can only give guided tours a few times a day, really, because we have limited capacity, a small staff.
I've heard that this museum is going to be the only visual arts museum in Las Vegas.
It is. Unfortunately, we no longer have an art museum, which is tragic, and, well, tragic pretty much sums it up. you know, I think that sometimes there's a bit of an inferiority complex culturally in Las Vegas, but you know, we're not New York, we're not LA, we're not other cities, we're Las Vegas, and that means something completely different. And we do have museums and we do have culture. A lot of it is popular culture, and that's not a bad thing. Popular culture has its own, you know, significant place to be celebrated.
That they all look so wonderfully retro.
They, well, yeah, I mean, in a way, the pinnacle of Las Vegas, the sort of penultimate Las Vegas experience, is mid-century. So the Rat Pack, all that sort of thing. And a lot of the signs that we do have are from the 60s, but our oldest signs are from the 30s. And we have signs that were built as recently as 5 years ago for businesses that have gone away, and we've taken in their signage.
I must just comment on this sign that we're passing right now. It's like a 10 or 15 foot guy in flares and a work shirt playing snooker. And he looks like he's got spaghetti for hair, but it's amazing. What is it?
Well, it's exactly it. It's a snooker player, or it was a sign for a pool hall. I'm glad you noticed the cut of his pants, his nice flared pants, his tropical shirt. And I'm a really big fan of his hair, not just the kind of, it looks like macaroni, but also that it's this fine, fine mullet. So it was done in the very early 80s. The sign was built. It has no neon on it at all. So signs weren't just for, you know, nighttime viewing, especially in a 24-hour city. You know, you've got people getting off of work at 8 in the morning, and maybe they want to go catch a game of pool.
There are these associations with neon. Neon is gaudy. Las Vegas is gaudy. What would you say to someone who says a neon is just, it's just gaudiness?
Well, what's wrong with that? First of all, you know, I don't think they're gaudy. I think that's a spectacular, maybe a little kitsch. I mean, neon signs used to be called spectaculars. There's still something for me, obviously, because I'm here and I love signs, but people come here all the time. People latch on to the neon sign all over the world because it is spectacular. Not necessarily gaudy. I would say Baroque, maybe, in a contemporary sort of way. I think having things that are over the top and splendid in our world is not a bad thing.
That was Danielle Kelly from Las Vegas' Neon Museum talking to Monocle's Alistair G for Culture here on Monocle 24.
At 1800 hours London time, tune into Midori House, the hour-long show that lifts the lid on the daily workings at Monocle's HQ. We delve deeper into the stories of the latest issue of Monocle and catch up with our editors and correspondents on the road as they put together the next one. Tune in at 1800 hours London time and finish the working day with Midori House, live every weekday.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
It's the smoothest of the smooth. It's a culture show with me, Robert Bound. Time for another track from my album of the week, Union by Saint Saviour. This is This Ain't No Hymn. And that was This Ain't No Hymn by Saint Saviour from her debut record called Union. And while that song was playing, Katie and I were discussing the fact that if Kate Bush was making her first album today, it might sound a little bit like that. I guess you can hear some echoes of that in there yourself. ¶¶ Still to come in part two, we'll be posing for our close-up with rock and roll snapper Harry Benson. We'll sit down with veteran Spanish reporter Pura Ramos, talk new curators with Imani Olu in New York, and soak up some sounds from the gay pride parade in São Paulo. Why would you ever listen to anything else? Having photographed every American president since Eisenhower, the civil rights movement, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and manoeuvres with the IRA, the image that may define Harry Benson's career is one he took of the Beatles having a pillow fight during the mid-60s at the dawn of Beatlemania. Assigned to cover the Fab Four on tours from 1964 to 66, Benson was with the band when they filmed A Hard Day's Night, played the iconic Shea Stadium concert, and even introduced them to Muhammad Ali. This month, Tashin published many of Benson's photographs from this period, and New York bureau chief caught up with the photographer over a cup of tea at his Manhattan home.
I think it's the most important part of the Beatles. In fact, the most important part of anybody is the beginning of how they start, and they don't know where they're going, they're not sure about how good they are. But the four of them, so they've got, they can lean on each other. So, and that makes it a lot easier. It's not as if you're alone and you've got some hideous publicists telling you what to do or whatever. So, I mean, they were getting feedback from themselves. And they had played in a lot of clubs. So they were tough. They knew. Lennon and McCartney were also educated. We weren't talking about, you know, sort of working class guys who could sing at the corner in the pub. No. They were clever.
And how did you first get introduced to the Beatles? How did you start working with them? Was it 1964?
Yes. I worked for the Daily Express on Fleet Street, which at that time was the best newspaper in London, certainly, because it was more adventurous, would be more, and of course I worked for it, you know. But no, I was going off to Australia, not Australia, Africa, to do a story on Uhuru, Independence, a year later, Kenya, Uganda, Tanganyika, Zanzibar, and this was a big story, how they were coping with independence. Mm-hmm. Weren't coping that well. A couple of coup d'etats there, you know. Anyway, I was going and I was all set and I had all my shots. I was a serious journalist. So anyway, I got a call this night, late, just to say, we'd like you to go with the Beatles tomorrow. I explained where I was going. And the night preacher said, okay, Harry, that's fine. Have a good time in Africa. Wow, that was a close one. You know, put the phone down. No more. 5 minutes later, the phone goes. The editor says, you're going to Paris with the Beatles. That's it, because, you know, you do what you're told. You don't argue with the editor, you know, and anyway, I knew who they were, and but wasn't quite into it. I wasn't into it because they hadn't broken out, really. There were no question they were on the rise, and I was well aware of it. Anyway, I go to Paris. I go to Paris with the Beatles, and we stayed at the George Sank Hotel, and they were going to open the following night. But the night, the day we arrived, they decide to do a gig out in Fontainebleau. Go there, and I'm not that happy, because I'm thinking Africa and all that. Anyway, I go back to my car for another piece of equipment. Not too happy, and I walk back in the hall, And the Beatles were starting, and I hear, close your eyes and I'll kiss you, oh my lover. I thought, Christ, I'm in the right story. This is the right story. It was sensational and amusing. I knew this was a big story.
Do you have a favourite image? I mean, it must be so hard because... is there a favourite period of the time that you're with them? Because you're with them twice. Is that what I understand?
No, I was with them... I was with them a few times. Because it was the Hard Day's Night. You know, and in Chicago when he said he was more popular than Jesus.
Right.
And he was sorry for that. John was very sorry because the other three were getting on to him because they were going to have to close. They were talking about not going on that night, not being banned.
Really?
Yes. That was in Chicago, of all places, yeah.
Now you live here in the States. How do you see that time of when they were here in the States? Because it was the 60s was such a hugely important moment for America. What was it like touring with the Beatles then?
They'd got more sophisticated, a bit tired of it. They were serious. Still in control, still knowing that what they have to do is turn out good music. And because Lennon and McCartney were both clever people. Mm. They weren't people weren't a couple of guys that were just looking for girls. You know, mm. Although that did play a little part. I won't be naive, you know. Beatlemania was really quite solid. I mean, I personally think Beatlemania started in Paris. Because everything seemed to move from then. It was like they were told they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Number one, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that was the night I took my pillow fight picture. When I said, let's have a pillow fight. They said yes, and then John said, no, we look a bit childish. No, we've got to be serious. And the other three said, yes, yes, yes. Then John comes up and bangs Paul in the back of the head or something. It was so. And it's good to have them when they're young.
Did you notice a shift between, I guess, 1964 and 1966?
Yes, yes.
That they were more considerate of their image? And how did the music and the image balance out?
Well, they were now becoming very rich. You know, they're talking about then getting this house. Like in Mayfair, or you know, where before they were talking about, and we may get 15 months out of this, and we could write tunes for Lennon McCartney, we could write tunes for the West End, and George could become a guitarist, and Ringo wanted to open a hairdresser. That's what they're talking about then. This wasn't what they were talking about now. 2 years later, right, was a big jump.
What did you enjoy the most about either being with them or shooting them? What was important for you?
Important to me was taking good pictures. That's all. I've never really cared what people think of me afterwards. Although it's nice to say you're a nice fella, but that wasn't what I intended, you know. My thing has always been take a good picture and then get out of Dodge. I don't want to get close to them. I photograph what I see, and what I see should inform, you know. And I don't like posing pictures. I've done it. I do it for covers. But it's not a real photograph. Anything that can be repeated, it's been repeated. It's not a real photograph. And I don't call that art, I just say it's shit, you know what I mean? You know, the pillow fight was spontaneous. That could never happen again.
Yeah.
A good photograph is a glimpse and gone forever. Can never be repeated. I've photographed every American president since Eisenhower. I was next to Bobby when he was shot. You know, I was a news photographer. I wasn't rock and roll. I mean, yes, I photographed the Stones and the Who. But, you know, after you do them, who wants to do Hall & Oates?
That was Harry Benson speaking with Monocle's Aisha Spears. Now, Queen Elizabeth II isn't the only one celebrating her Diamond Jubilee. At 80 years old, veteran Spanish journalist Pura Ramos has enjoyed a colourful 60-year-long career. She's seen it all, from being one of the first female reporters in Spain working under the Franco dictatorship and witnessing the worst of ETA's campaign of terror, to being the press secretary for the Prado Museum and her current role as writer for the monthly Ars magazine. She's also somehow managed to mother 8 children along the way. Our reporter Liam Aldous sat down with Donna Ramos to reflect on a life that shows no signs of slowing down just yet.
I am a journalist. I have been working as a journalist for 61 years now. I am 80, but I love my work, really. I don't know when I can give up my job. Every day I tell myself, perhaps in Christmas my time, no, it's better after holidays, summer holidays, and finally I keep up. I don't want to give up, really. So I am never able to bring myself to do it.
You started in 1952. It was very difficult for a woman in this profession. Can you tell me where you came across an obstacle as a journalist because you were a woman?
My first work in journalism was in a newspaper, Pueblo. In this Pueblo, only a woman worked as a journalist, Pilar Nervión. Me was the second one. I have a very rich and full experiences as a journalist. For instance, I had to write about and report on current events at several wars, Dien Bien Phu, Vietnam. I killed 2 Kennedys.
You're very famous for saying that you killed 2 Kennedys. What do you mean by that, you killed 2 Kennedys?
Because it's the same what journalist said. What about you have to write or to report? And in my case, I assassination 2 Kennedys, 2 Pope, Carrero Blanco. Do you know who was Carrero Blanco?
He was a Spanish minister who was assassinated.
Yes. Carrero Blanco, you know, up to the heaven.
He went up to the heaven, yeah, but literally, no, in the car, the explosion was so big that the car flew up into the air and went over a building and landed in the interior of a building. How was it working under the Franco dictatorship as a journalist? So you didn't have to cover national politics, but even international politics may have been difficult because of the censorship. How was it working for you and your colleagues under the Franco regime?
Not in international politics, because I think the journalists have the censorship yourself.
The self-censorship, yes.
They know what have to write and what you don't do it. In the end, the responsible was the editor-in-chief, not the redactor. This is good for the redactor, because if Franco need to cut the head, not are going to cut the head of the journalist, if yes, to the editor-in-chief.
So when Franco died, the door was flung open and a lot of external influences came into Spain, and suddenly the younger generation were overwhelmed with freedom. And this started in Madrid, more or less, and this was called the La Movida, which is a period of history which particularly interests me, because it was post-dictatorship Spain. It was almost a cultural revolution. And how was it for you? I mean, you were in your 50s this time, so you could see the difference. How was it as a journalist, and how was it as a citizen to see La Movida?
La Movida is it's a movement for me. I think it's was a more cultural movement amongst young people. Also, there were wind of freedom blowing from other countries. One of the mayor at this time, Tierno Galván, was fond of this movement. I think it was movement more on the left than on the right.
From the right, yeah.
Because the ideas on the right, nothing at all like conservative idea.
On your career of 60-something years, it's incredible. How have you seen the profession change, and how would you consider it now? You're still working as a journalist. What are the differences now as to how they were working so many years ago?
It is different. You are now very, very lazy. For instance, in my time, never había ruedas de prensa.
Press conferences.
Press conference, never. You have to investigate or to go around the news yourself. You need to go to the minister or to go to see one man, perhaps know something that you want to know, but never a conference press, never. Now, the minister or the power that be give you a paper, and many of my colleagues write just the same paper because it's easier to do that instead to write really and to answer.
How can we be better?
A piece of advice that an important and wise Spanish intellectual, Menéndez Pidal, gave me when I began to start as a journalist. He, I remember, told me, no matter what you do, do your very best, even if it is an humble task.
That was veteran Spanish reporter Pura Ramos talking to Monocle's Liam Aldous. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. To New York, next.
Long overshadowed by its neighbors, Seoul's creative community is flourishing as a new generation of designers are developing new projects and pieces. Monocle's Gabriel Lee traveled to South Korea to meet some of the people leading the charge.
Indeed, many in the creative community here have studied or worked abroad and now come back, melding their experience in the world with a Korean aesthetic and creating something new and appealing. This is the first generation to have done this on such a scale.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cozy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
Survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
This show, by the way, is best enjoyed with a gin and tonic. You're with Culture, with me, Robert Bounds. Now, there was a time in the not-so-distant past that becoming a curator involved years of academic training, followed by a harrowing march through the favoured institutions, all with hopes of someday mustering the skill and gravitas to put on a show. A new show from New York-based curator Amani Olu at Chelsea's Mühlenstein Gallery focuses on the great curatorial liberalisation of our era and where experimentation can take us. Young Ideas, New Curators brings together 12 curators presenting a single group show featuring work from 29 artists. With each curator taking a unique approach, there's a real sense of experimentation present not only in the works themselves, but more strikingly in how they've been selected and put on show. For more on this, Monocle's Barrett Austin caught up with Amani Olu just before the opening of the show.
The focus on this year's show is experimentation with the group show format and looking at different mediums and practices and how to slightly bend them to take us and the viewer toward a new direction of understanding practices and mediums that we feel like we're comfortable with, trying to push us out of the box a little bit.
And how did the first edition of Young Curators' New Idea come to be?
I was working at a gallery, now defunct gallery, called Bond Street Gallery in 2008. I was hired as a director and curator. And they asked me to produce a show in August at the very last minute. I didn't really have anything planned or any ideas for an exhibition, and I wasn't really comfortable at the time in my own skills as a curator, although I was hired as a director-curator. So, charged with this task at the very last minute, I called all my friends who said they wanted to do projects in the space. And I said, hey, you know, I'll give you 10 feet of wall space, because it was a very small gallery. It was two floors, but super small. 10 feet of wall space to do whatever you want to do. And they submitted proposals, you know, like a paragraph. And we did the show, and it was born out of this necessity to this sort of demand to create.
And you being the curator of curators in this show, how did you select the people that you work with this year?
We did an open call through Art Agenda. I sent out some personal notes, so did the gallery. And we received about 108 curatorial proposals, and I read them all twice, narrowed it down to 24, read them all another, you know, two or three times, and then narrowed it down to the 12 we have now. So it was a very difficult process, because you are trying to find proposals that are smart and interesting, but that the work also holds. You know, you can't have, you know, all these great ideas on paper and then they don't translate into, you know, the real world.
And to play the role of judge, which curatorial approaches or works in general have you been most excited by this year?
I'm really excited about Jordana Zeldin, her piece. She's working with Ben Alper and Judith Schimmer. It's about memory and the past and how we understand our childhood. And I was really interested in it conceptually. The work looks great. And I think it really appeals to my own personal history and background of memory and childhood and loss and things like that. And what she's doing is she's showing a video with four photographs, and there's a couch, and it's on the second floor, or the bottom floor rather. And it has this very authentic basement den kind of recreational room quality. So when you walk into the space, you don't really feel like you're in an exhibition. It's kind of outside of like the proper white box like you might find with some of the other proposals. And it's just really successful in terms of that transition, that trajectory from paper to being in an actual space. It just really works.
And you often hear about the idea of the emerging artist in the art world, but it seems that increasingly you hear this idea of the emerging curator. How do you think this came to be? And what would you say is the position of the curator in today's art world?
The curator is a facilitator. They help edit and vet what dealers, museum professionals, what the public sees. Galleries can't do it on their own. Institutional curators, because of the confines that they're working in, they're not able to move as quickly. Independent curators, they can meet an artist, go to their studio the next day, and write them into a proposal. And if they have the right space, they have a show. So they just help organize all of this information into, I won't say neatly packaged boxes, but, you know, they organize it in a way where you can sort of decide what you should be looking at. Because otherwise, you wouldn't really have anyone. It would just be the institutions and the artists themselves. And I'm sure that that has worked for many, many years. But I think people would say there are a lot more artists today than there was, you know, 60 years ago.
And what are you really trying to accomplish with all of this? What's your goal in putting on this show?
I want to work with curators who are producing exhibitions that don't really work inside a normal gallery program. This is a space to experiment. This is a space to fail, to triumph. There are rules, but there aren't any real rules. It's really about working in the confines of a specific space and being able to minimalize your perspective to work not just as an exhibition, but an exhibition within a number of exhibitions, but really giving people a space to just play around and have fun and, you know, figure out if they even like being a curator. I mean, Larry Osei Mensa, who's working with Hugo McLeod, this is arguably his first real curatorial endeavor. You know, it's about working with people like that and giving them a chance to break into this particular field.
And that was Amani Olu speaking with Monocle's Barrett Austin in New York City. Few minutes in the world are sweeter than this one. Yes, that's right. It's time for another of our 60-second sensory specialities. For this week's Minute of Sound, we popped over to Gay Pride in São Paulo. Enjoy!
No fim, os brasileiros é tudo bicha, cara.
And that was a minute of sound from Gay Pride in São Paulo, courtesy of Sheena Rossiter, which brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, we'll be off to the big art market event of the year, Art Basel, among other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie the Rock, Bill Boer, and the show was mixed by the blonde beauty that is Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from my album of the week, Union by Saint Xavier. This is Reasons. Thanks for tuning in.